Good afternoon, everybody. We're gonna get started, although you can continue eating and continue getting food as we get started here today. Thank you so much. Thanks so much to all of you for coming this afternoon. My name is Sid Milkus. I'm from the Department of Politics at the University of Virginia, and I also head a program called Studies in Democracy and Governance at the Miller Center of Public Affairs. That's our building down in Charlottesville. You all come down there next week, okay? But we also just opened up an office in Washington, D.C., and this is just the kind of event we love doing up here. The conversation we're having today, titled creatively by my co-conspirator and good friend Michael Malbin, "How Will History Judge the Impact of Citizens United versus FEC?" is at the heart of the Miller Center's mission to work at the exciting but sparsely populated intersection of scholarship and public affairs. Our task is to place important political and policy debates in a broad historical and philosophical context, and at the same time, to hold these broad scholarly perspectives accountable to the expertise of those public officials on the front lines of policy debates and resolutions. I'm really deeply grateful to Governor Gerald Blyles, the director of the Miller Center, for supporting my colleague's ambition to probe the deep roots of Citizens United. He couldn't be here today. He's got important work to do in Charlottesville, but I know he'll be watching this event. And I'm also honored and delighted that Michael Malbin of the Campaign Finance Institute agreed to host this event with the Miller Center. And my colleagues and I also want to thank Senator Webb and his staff for their help in enabling us to hold this event in the Capitol Visitor Center. And of course, we want to thank C-SPAN providing live coverage of this event. When Michael and I first started planning this luncheon, our hope was to organize a discussion that did justice, no pun intended, to Citizens United, a highly contested 5-4 decision that reinforces and amplifies the right of groups like corporations and labor unions to spend money on campaigns. The extraordinary attention this case has gotten from the White House to the Congress to state governments and journalists, it's not hype. Citizens has the potential to deeply affect the most important enduring issues that have shaped and roiled America's experiment in constitutional democracy. It affects things like the tension between minority rule and the rights of minorities, the struggle to reconcile interest groups, always central to American democracy, with some sense of the exalted, elusive idea of the public interest, and the uneasy connection between commerce and self-government. We're really fortunate to have an unusually gifted group of scholars and practitioners to provide the sort of rich and stimulating discussion of Citizens United and also some of the proposals that have been prescribed to modify its effect on American democracy deserve. To start things off, I've asked three panelists to discuss the historical, philosophical, and practical implications of the case. Then we'll turn to four respondents, all eminent experts on campaign spending, to offer a reality check, or as we sometimes call it at the Miller Center, tough love on these three perspectives. I've asked our panelists to keep their remarks brief, and there should be plenty of time after the initial discussion among them for your questions and comments. Looking over the RSVP list, we have a very distinguished audience, and we want to get as many of you involved in our discussion as possible today. Before we begin, let me introduce our panel in the order in which they'll be speaking. In the interest of time, I'm going to recognize them very briefly. I'm not going to begin to convey their exceptional records of accomplishment. Jerry Burke is a professor of political science at the University of Oregon. His most recent book, Louis Brandeis and the Making of Regulated Competition, confirms Jerry's reputation as a foremost scholar of the political economy. And I think he's absolutely the best to enlighten us about the historical development of the corporation. Nancy Rosenblum is the Senator Joseph Clark Professor of Ethics in Politics and Government. I love Nancy's work because she's a political theorist who has a deep appreciation of politics. Maybe that's what that explains why she was just elected Vice President of the American Political Science Association. Nancy's most recent book, On the Side of the Angels, An Appreciation of Parties and Partisanship, is the best philosophical study I have read on how progressive reforms like campaign finance reform have affected political parties and, more broadly, American democracy. I've already expressed my respect and affection for our third panelist, Michael Malbin. Many of you here today know Michael from his inspired and inspiring leadership of the Campaign Finance Institute. Of course, he's also a professor of political science at the University of Albany SUNY. And I first got to know Michael as a mentor of sorts. Although I never had the privilege to study with him, he taught me the importance of combining investigation of core American values and rigorous empirical research. Michael was the one who taught me that interesting data is not an oxymoron. And I'm really looking forward, as I'm sure most of you are, to hearing his analysis of the latest data on spending patterns thus far in the 2010 election. He and his staff, I know, were working all night to get that data together for us today. Our first respondent will be Allison Hayward, who is Vice President of Policy at the Center for Competitive Politics. Allison wrote a very impressive amicus brief for the plaintiffs in the Citizen case and some equally impressive defenses of the decision since it was issued. She poses really strong challenges to the view that this case denigrates the idea and practice of American democracy. Peter Overby, to my right here, is one of my favorite NPR reporters, and I'm not damning you with faint praise in saying that. I like NPR. I'm a big fan of the creative and sophisticated way he follows the money trail. And I'm not alone. In 2002, Peter received the Alfred I. DuPont Columbia University Silver Baton, one of the highest honors in broadcast news, for reporting that, as the award said, set the bar for stories about money, power, and political influence. Spencer Overton is professor of law at the Georgetown University Law School. His writing shows him to be deeply interested in the obstacles to self-government in a large, complex, commercial republic. And Spencer has practiced what he preaches, from 2009 to 2010. He was the principal deputy assistant attorney general at the Department of Justice in the Office of Legal Policy, a vantage point that allowed him to partner with the Office of White House Counsel and the White House Domestic Policy Council to lead the Obama administration's policy efforts on democracy and government reform. We will also be joined by Trevor Potter. He's on his way in a cab. And he will be here by 12:30, so I'm going to introduce him when he gets here. So with the introduction of our outstanding panel, we're going to begin with Jerry.
Thanks, Sid. Everybody hear me? Is the mic on? Yep. Okay. Can someone put up that cartoon?
Michael, can you put up the cartoon?
Well, anyway, thanks to Sid. I'll start, and we'll get the cartoon up there in a minute. I really want to thank Sid for inviting me here today. It's an incredible honor to be here at the behest of the Miller Center in Washington and with this terrific group of panelists. As I understand it, my role on this panel is to try to stimulate some discussion up here and among you as well, by putting Citizens United within a broad historical context. So what I'd like to do today is to open with a brief account of the historical and changing status of the business corporation before the law, and then talk a little bit about how social movements and, in particular, left-wing intellectuals historically and maybe even in the present responded to the growing autonomy of the corporation from its shareholders and from the state. So I don't suspect you can read this cartoon, unfortunately. I was hoping that you could. I hadn't planned on reading it, but I will read it. I'll use my best dramatic voices, you know. I don't know if I can do this little girl, but no, This is a cartoon that was sent to me by a former student who worked on Wall Street, lost his job on Wall Street. I think he's working a bit more these days. Anyway, so I'll read it. It says, "The Fight for Corporate Rights, America's Shame." It's a little girl saying to her dad, "Daddy, this old story, a company goes bankrupt." "What's bankrupt?" "Oh, honey. In the early 21st century, corporations were thought of merely as things, defined legally as persons, but an inferior class with less rights than you and I. At that time, if they were in failing health, corporations would be allowed to go bankrupt, to die." And then these guys at the bottom are saying, "Oh, we did all we could. It's gone. But two wise and brave presidents stopped the carnage and gave failing corporations bailouts." It says, "Monument to Corporate Rights" here. If you can see Bush and Obama there. "A corporation would not be left to die again. America then couldn't afford health care for its so-called natural persons, but that was a step towards writing centuries of discrimination. Then, in 2010, in a landmark decision, the Supreme Court ruled that corporations have full First Amendment rights. Speak freely, corporations, says the courts. The struggle was long and hard fought, but eventually America recognized that corporations truly are people. The placards of these guys say, 'We shall overcapitalize,' legal fictions, but their feelings are real, corporate power. And today, corporations are valued citizens with the same rights as anyone. Now say goodnight to your mommy and go to bed." And the little girl says, "Goodnight, Dow Chemical Company. I love you." So, anyway, you know, I show this cartoon because I think it's clever and I think it's funny. But, you know, as a student of the political history of the corporation, I was amazed, actually, at how much it reminded me how much history can repeat itself, or maybe how much the same story gets played out over and over again. We've never changed the story in some ways. As I read it, this cartoon tells the story of the development of corporate legal rights over the past decade, freedom from bankruptcy, freedom and freedom from both economic and political regulation. This is a lot like the story of the modern corporation at its birth in the late 19th century. The leading sector of American industrialization was the railroads, and they were the first to use the corporate form extensively. Like real estate today, though, railroads were massively overbuilt in the late 19th century. And as a result, over half the mileage in the United States collapsed and fell into insolvency, all in the, from the 1870s to the 1890s. While the federal government didn't bail out those railroad corporations, the federal courts actively protected railroad corporations from the claims of their creditors. There was no national bankruptcy law at the time, so when railroad corporations failed to pay their debts, they landed in federal court where managers were booted out and they were put in receivership until they could be reorganized. Until the 1880s, the courts conceived of corporations in receivership as no more than the legal sum of the many individual private contracts with their shareholders, right? So corporations had no autonomous status. They were just a bunch of contracts, individual contracts. Legal historian Morton Horowitz calls this the private artificial entity theory of the corporation. It wasn't seen as natural. It was seen as a creation of its creditors and its shareholders. Well, all this changed in 1884 when the famous robber baron Jay Gould sent his lieutenants into a federal district court in St. Louis and asked the judge, this federal judge, to put his Wabash Railway into receivership prior to default. This was unprecedented, right? A corporation only goes into receivership once it's failed to pay its debts. Basically, what they do is they go in, they know they're not going to be able to pay their debts. They go into court, they say, "Put us into receivership prior to the creditors putting us into receivership. And they ask the judge as well to appoint the incumbent managers of the corporation to be the receivers. Any other option, they argued, would decimate not only the Wabash Railway, but its relationship to Jay Gould's huge national integrated system. The corporation, they argued, not merely the railroad, but the corporation, they argued, had value. Its individual contracts had none. Well, the court agreed. And in doing so, it ushered in a new era of thinking about the corporation. It was now thought of as an autonomous and natural being with legal status prior to its individual contracts with shareholders, or for that matter, with workers who were also needed to be paid. They were also part of the debt of what corporations owed. The corporation was, in fact, then seen as a natural person. State legislatures and the U.S. Congress responded in kind. If huge, powerful railroad corporations were no longer regulated by their contracts, or for that matter, by the market, then it was justified for government to regulate them. But in a series of court cases calling into question the right of legislatures to exercise police powers over the railroads, the courts hemmed in government regulation by defining the corporation, once again, as a natural person with rights to due process under the Fifth and the 14th Amendments to the Constitution. This didn't mean, of course, that regulation was unlawful. The Supreme Court found the Interstate Commerce Act, which was created to regulate the railroads, constitutional. It merely meant that there were strict constitutional boundaries on regulation, and it would be the courts, not legislatures, which would police those boundaries. So by the turn of the century, the business corporation had been redefined as a natural entity, which, like a natural person, had constitutional rights independent of the state and independent of its shareholders. Well, social movements and left-wing intellectuals disagreed pretty vehemently about how to respond to the legal redefinition of the modern corporation at this time. Some, like the American Federation of Labor, the leaders of that organization, and Theodore Roosevelt's advisor, Herbert Crowley, welcomed the natural entity theory of the corporation because it undermined the ideology of free markets and justified building capacity, building countervailing powers in labor unions and in the state. Indeed, it was this logic that underpinned the 1907 Tillman Act, which regulated corporate participation in elections. Others, however, like the Farmers Alliance, the Knights of Labor, and Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, argued that the legal concentration of corporate power imperiled both liberty and democracy. As Brandeis put it in his critique of the other side, despotism with safeguards is still despotism. In Brandeis's view, in the view of the leaders of the Knights of Labor, it was necessary to reverse the legal decisions which accorded personhood to corporations and break up concentrations of corporate power through antitrust law. This debate, I don't think, was ever fully resolved in the 20th century. Indeed, it seems to reemerge like clockwork at moments when questions of corporate power become very public, moments like the New Deal, the 1960s, and maybe today. Citizens United, remember, overturns a portion of a statute which pertains to both business and labor. It accords corporations and unions freedom from regulation under the First Amendment to the Constitution. And so, like the AFL in 1900, the AFL-CIO and AFSCME, in fact, today have applauded Citizens United. Indeed, it was AFSCME, not corporations, who first used the ruling to advertise so effectively against Blanche Lincoln in last spring's Democratic primary race for Senate in Arkansas. But like the historical division between the Knights of Labor and the AFL, the labor movement is now deeply divided again over the status of corporations and their participation in elections. They're deeply divided over Citizens United. SEIU, for example, has come out unequivocally against the ruling. Like the Knights of Labor before them and Brandeis, they complain that granting rights written for natural persons to corporations makes a sham of the Constitution because it tips electoral competition so heavily in favor of business. But maybe the most cogent critique of Citizens United from this sort of perspective came from Justice Stevens, whose dissent cites a long history of cautions against corporate personhood from Jefferson and Brandeis to McCain and Feingold. So thanks. I hope I've added some historical perspective to this case and to the discussion.
Great. Thanks, Jerry. Nancy?
You don't want to
I'm going to wait till he's ready to talk. Welcome, Trevor. Nice to have you.
My self-assigned topic is political parties and the anxiety of influence. The sides in this discussion, of which Citizens United is just a part, share two things. Two things beyond the fact that though there are many avenues of undue influence, of access, of indebtedness, of bad dependency, in a word, of clientelism, since the 1970s, political energy has focused on money in campaigns and elections. So one thing the sides share is that from the point of view of political theory, which is my field, the operative idea of political equality is frustratingly vague and truncated. For progressives then and now, inequality, not equality, is key. An agreement about what unequal resources or objectionable where is elusive, apart from certain repulsive things, apart from unparalleled corporate resources or billionaire mega donors. The rhetoric is familiar. Big and flood are the prime terms. Big money floods elections. For the Citizens United majority, of course, the misnamed equality rationale is constitutionally unacceptable. But importantly, both sides take up just one facet of inequality, big money. Not the political weightlessness of the poor and disorganized for whom the participation deficit is disturbingly enduring. The second thing the sides share is what I'll call anti-partyism. The Citizens United majority liberated corporations to use treasury funds and advocacy and interest groups to solicit unlimited amounts to influence elections, but they preserved constraints on parties, prohibiting them from spending in coordination with their candidates, as if candidates should be or appear to be independent, and from raising and spending non-federal funds for any purpose, including non-campaign activities. The dissent in Citizens United noted this disadvantage, but like other progressive critics, they don't object to excluding parties from the general liberation. Neither side is particularly inhibited when it comes to crimping parties' institutional effectiveness and underscoring popular aversion to partisanship. It's as if parties are just one other interest group amongst others, perhaps a worse one. Well, American anti-partyism is not surprising. Antipathy is episodic only in the sense that it's more or less virulent. And we know that partisan is a dependable invective. It's a durable term of abuse. The progressive era introduced a spate of reforms that was intended to weaken or eliminate political parties, from limiting patronage to primary elections to the presumably purifying vote for women. Didn't work. They lauded non-institutional forms of political activity like social movements and citizen advocacy groups. And in an era of mass democracy, the progressives reiterated the American penchant for nonpartisan independent voters. All of this is live today. Independence has a definite luster. It's not just a political fact, but a boasted political identity. Now, there are reasons why we should want to check anti-partyism and recognize that political participation, competition, representation, deliberation, governing, and the glue of our federal system require strong parties. Let me just make four obvious points that are affirmed by political science and justified, I think, by normative political theory. Parties continue to play their original role of going beyond ad hoc coalitions on specific issues to organize government. They provide at least minimal political accountability and enable the peaceful turnover of governments. They provide comparatively comprehensive accounts of public issues and the public good, and they draw comparatively coherent lines of political division that moderate and temper special interest groups, sinister interest groups, single-issue advocacy groups, and self-styled public interest groups. They find, recruit, and train candidates at every level of government, ideally then creating an organizational capacity to integrate national and state parties. And they encourage participation by registering and mobilizing voters and by creating partisans who are, by the way, the most consistent participants. And this last point, I think, is worth noting. In the United States, parties have been the most persistent force behind the expansion of the electorate. There are three reasons why people don't participate. They don't want to, they can't, or most importantly, it seems, no one asked. And this last cause of effective disenfranchisement is the one that parties have historically addressed. So statutory obstacles that scatter responsibility for funds and organization exacerbate the fragmentation of influence. They provoke the formation of shadow parties, interest and advocacy groups' tails that wag the party dog. They hobble ties between national and state parties. And they reduce parties' capacity and willingness to compensate for political inequality of participation. Now, pushed, many critics of parties will grudgingly concede that no other institution has either the responsibility or the capacity to serve these purposes. They stand in clear contrast to corporations whose single-minded aim is profit, or ought to be. One of the concerns about Citizens United is it's going to divert managers from business interest to ideology. And as important, parties stand in clear contrast to innumerable interest and advocacy groups. These groups, whether they're populist or professional, seek to influence, not to occupy office. They lack institutional permanence. They lack accountability. They're organized not to govern but to pressure. And as one political operative put it, inverting the text of a burlesque song, I love this, every little meaning has a movement of its own. I should add that in a world of organized interests, these groups multiply the effects of persistent intergenerational political inequality. So any acceptance of parties, for the most part, is pragmatic, unexuberant, unphilosophical, and grudging, and it doesn't weaken the rationales that are put forth for putting parties at a disadvantage relative to these other groups. One rationale is the obvious one. That is that parties corrupt democracy by channeling money from corporations and interest groups, abetting in the evasion of contribution limits and the creation of dependencies that reformers would sever. And you'll notice that on this view, it makes little difference whether parties are agents or principals. That is, whether they're the instruments of special interests or extortionists involved in an elaborate influence peddling scheme. But the anxiety of influence is more complex, and I want to make this point clear. There's a separate rationale that casts parties as ambitious actors pursuing their own special, even sinister interests in gaining and entrenching control of government. And on this view, every form of spending by political parties creates reliance and obligations on the part of candidates and officials. In Justice Byron White's striking formulation, and I'm quoting here, effective use of party resources in support of party candidates may encourage candidate loyalty and responsiveness to the party. This overwrought suggestion that loyalty and responsiveness are self-evident evils fails to acknowledge what I think ought to be the self-evident democratic good of a reasonable degree of party unity, not least because parties are one institution that are at least potentially a resource of resistance to lobbying and to other improper dependencies. That is, this institution can do what independent good souls cannot. Well, what should be done now that the law gives greater latitude to corporations and interest groups while maintaining specific burdens on parties? Two responses favored by progressives look to excite a new politics of voter participation via donations, a democratic fix for undemocratic dependency. In a reverse of the usual negative imagery, small donations will flood the system and dilute big money. This is the idea behind the theoretically consistent but politically impracticable idea of vouchers, where every citizen has a voucher that they can give to a candidate. Parties aren't excluded as recipients of vouchers, but they're not favored either. And the same idea, of course, lies behind public financing. In contrast to most democracies, public financing in the United States is designed to support individual candidates and to bypass parties. On their own terms, advocates concede that it's doubtful that the diffusion of small money would reduce, much less offset, big money and clientelism. These proposals might get more small donors out, but not a less affluent set. That is, once again, they don't address the politically worst off. And so from my standpoint, if public funding could be legislated, funded, and accepted, all of them questionable coulds, a mix of distribution schemes to candidates and parties would be desirable. There are two other fixes that are more promising from my point of view because they're less candidate and more party-focused. They will begin to lift the constraints that compel national parties to engage in what's been called the unnatural act of disassociation from its candidates and from state and local counterparts. The Campaign Finance Institute, and you're going to hear from Michael in a moment, proposes to allow unlimited coordinated expenditures between parties and candidates if contributions are made in small amounts. True, the dynamic of gratitude would remain, but I think that links between federal and state parties and candidates, not firewalls, are what's needed. The chief objective, as I understand it, behind this proposal, however, is to provide incentives for parties to solicit small donations and thereby enlarge the participatory pie. And insofar as the concern is also to strengthen parties relative to other groups, its effectiveness might likely turn on raising the ceiling of coordinated funds. Finally, when it comes to donations to parties dedicated to registering voters and get out the vote and organization and communications, I think we have to consider now soft money bans. Investment in long-term organization and education is arguably at least as important for exciting participation as small donations to candidates at elections. And dedicated soft money might spur parties to resume their historical role of mobilizing the discouraging number of passive citizens and politically incorporating immigrants, speaking to what I see as the most disturbing participation deficit. More broadly, I think that non-campaign party organization creates a horizon of political time that extends beyond the next frenetic news and election cycle. And it might provide some incentive to go beyond the rational prospecting that I think entrenches under representation. The American anti-party grain is etched particularly deeply today. Polarization and arrant uncompromisingness excite revulsion at partisanship and unreflective praise for independence. But you'll recall that it wasn't so long ago that the opposite aversion dominated and the parties were disparaged as centrist and indistinguishable, marked by convergence and collusion. Our assessments shift with the vicissitudes of politics and events, but systemic reforms of the democratic process really should attend, I think, to the distinctive purposes served only by parties and partisanship. We should be alert to what I think democracy stands to lose if parties are politically fragmented, if they're morally diminished, and if partisans are scolded and independents lauded. Thank you.
Thank you, Nancy. Michael?
Thank you, Sid. And I want to thank you and the Miller Center for having been great partners in this venture. I plan to speak in more immediate terms than the previous two speakers. I won't be talking about law or history or theory, although there will be some overlap with a pretty fair amount of overlap with some of what Nancy Rosenblum said. But I plan to take my start from the impact of Citizens United or on practical politics and policy. I have entitled my talk, Stop Whining and Start Working, a small donor response to Citizens United. There's been a basic theme running through the coverage of the role of interest groups in this year's election. The theme is more or less that the conventional wisdom is that there's been a huge increase. It's pro-Republican. It's led by business corporations as opposed to other kinds of entities such as advocacy groups. And that it was caused by Citizens United. Well, let's kind of divide the participants in elections into two different piles for the sake of showing you some information. And that is, we'll look at the money from kinds of expenditures that get reported or disclosed, and then those that do not. Reportable spending, yes, there has been a substantial increase, and yes, it's led by pro-Republican groups, as you can see here. And the bar charts for 2010 are about 75% higher for electioneering and independent spending than they were in 2008. And we're just looking at congressional election money in 2008 in all of our charts, or both of our charts. And the Republican bar went up a lot more quickly than the Democratic, or Democratic actually is slightly down so far. And these are measuring mid-October to mid-October, by the way. But, you know, reportable spending is only part of the whole picture. And it's, of course, in 2008, that was only 30% of the whole spending picture, and the rest was not reported spending by advocacy organizations, mostly nonprofits, organized as 501c3 or 4, not C3, advocacy C4s or C5s, labor unions, C6s, business associations. And what about 2010? You know, there is, after all, a possibility that this increase that you see was just a matter of moving money from one pile to another pile because Citizens United liberated it. And here's what happens, and these are just estimates because we're dealing with non-disclosed money, but it's consistent methodology and it's the best that anybody has. So Here's the estimated spending on congressional elections by political committees and nonprofits, including all the money that they estimate or budget. And what you see is an increase of about 40% from 08 to 10. So that means, yes, the totals are up 40%, not 75. So that means there is some migration from one set to another set. But still, there is more, and there's more in the and it is more on the Republican side than the Democratic. So much is true so far. Does this prove a Citizens United effect? I would say not so fast. If you go back to this table, you see that the surge really started, the big surge in the nonprofit money. This is hiding actually some of it. It's more dramatic in other kinds of tables. The big surge began in 2008. And what you're seeing in 2010 is kind of a continuation. So far, not a huge increase in the role of for-profit business corporations. Some, but not huge. Although that may happen in the future. So what this tells us is that the issue, and as Nancy Rosenblum explained earlier, the issue is much bigger than this specific legal decision or Citizens United. It's about rich and powerful people who are simply able to find ways to spend money under a variety of rules, and some people like that and some people don't. But the fact is that they do it. They can do it. So the question is, what if anything, should a policy response be? Well, if you basically like the way things are, nothing. Or do away with the regulations that are now there, and you know some of Allison's colleagues would like that. But if you don't like it, you know, if you don't like it, there are two main approaches that have been offered so far. One is disclosure, and the other is a kind of re-regulation or partial re-regulation as much as you can get. Well, from my perspective, I think enhanced disclosure is just fine, and we can debate that. But I think you'd be mistaken to think that would have a major effect on the balance of power or the role in the system. As far as re-regulation, well, I'd say let's revisit that point. It's time to start thinking again about these issues. I would describe the old approach to trying to stop spending. And I want to be clear about something. I support contribution limits. But this was the old approach to spending limits. It's the old strategy. Let's try to put a lid on all of this, and meanwhile it just oozes out the sides and there's not much you can do. And here's where I think this approach has brought us. I think it's brought us to a dead end. So as a result, we at the Campaign Finance Institute and other colleagues we've been working with have been making the argument that it's time to shift paradigms. It's time to think about building up, that is to enlarge the pot instead of sitting on the lid or trying to sit on the lid, and to do that as Nancy alluded, by trying to empower the many, to empower small donors and volunteers. There are any number of incentives out there for trying to enhance the role of small donors. There are direct donor incentives such as tax credits and rebates. And by the way, I should say in response to something that was said earlier, that rebates do have the effect of significantly changing the mix and the classes of people who participate in the system. There are party incentives, which you heard Nancy describe, and there are candidate incentives, such as matching funds, which I'll talk about in just a bit more. Question, would incentives like these make a significant difference to the overall balance of power? Again, I'm more optimistic about this than we've just heard. CFI has analyzed federal elections, all 50 states and New York City. In most elections, most money comes from big donors, people who give 1,000 or more in terms of their income. There tend to be over $250,000 in some states, though, and in New York City, the results were different. The government, if in New York City, for example, the government matches the first $175 with a 6-to-1 match. And let me just look at some of the results, and I could talk about other states, but you know we don't have forever. As in other public funding systems, candidates in New York have to choose whether to participate. It has to be a free choice. So if you look at candidates for the city council, which is their legislature, for those who did not participate, their funding looked pretty much like the average state legislature in the country. This is the mix of money, 64% from people who gave 1,000 or more, 17% from small donors who gave up to 250. But for participating candidates, the results are radically different. Just for the private money alone, for participating candidates, you have 37% instead of 17% coming from small donors, 31% instead of 65% from people who give 1,000 or more. And when you look at the multiplier effect and you attribute the matching money to the donor who actually gave it, this is what it looks like. 65% from small donors, 15% from large. And that change occurs without driving the large donors out of the system. The change occurs by trying to give incentive for candidates and parties to pay attention to bring new people into the system. This is a kind of summary table. So our conclusion is that these kinds of laws that focus on building up do or can have a major impact, not just a minor. They bring new people into the system, and from our survey work, we're convinced also a different mix of people into the system. And they shift the balance of power, or can shift the balance of power, without spending all of your time trying to sit on the lid. The important point is that empowering small donors is only partly about money. There are clearly links between giving and doing, between the kinds of incentives that get people to give small contributions and turning them into volunteers or turning them into becoming campaign actors. As a result, we think about this not principally about money or not only about money, but we think about this as affecting the political power of natural persons writ large in a large way. As a result, our bottom line for after Citizens United is simply it's time to shift gears. It's time to shift the way we think. And the reason to shift is because an approach based on participation can work.
Thank you. Is that the conclusion? I just want to make sure. Okay, thank you very much, Michael. All right, Allison, we'll start with you. Time for the reality checks.
Let's see if I've got them. Well, thanks very much for having me. I have but a few minutes, and so I will speak perhaps quickly, but also hopefully give you a few nuggets of wisdom to chew on. First of all, sort of as a preemptive and sort of general observation, I want to say that I think Nancy's comments are absolutely correct. To the extent there are people who are defending Citizens United who seem less than entirely sensitive to the burden that is being placed and the irrational burden that's being placed on the political activity by parties, I don't think I'm one of those people. And I hope that as time passes, what have up till now been unsuccessful litigation efforts to revisit some of those issues will be more successful. But as of now, the couple of challenges post Citizens United that have attempted to get courts to rethink the restrictions on political parties haven't done so well. And since this is ultimately a game of law as much as political philosophy or politics, that's a problem. I guess more generally what I want to say is that, you know, history is hard to see when you're part of it. So let's take a minute and just real quickly, what did Citizens United say? Citizens United said that the mere status of an entity as a corporation did not justify a complete ban on the making of independent expenditures in federal campaigns, and by extension, state and local campaigns, and by extension, trade unions too. Though why corporations and trade unions are treated equivalently in campaign finance law is an excellent question, and I can't really justify it myself, except that it's an artifact of history and sort of mid-century visions of how corporations and the economy were organized. But that's what it did. And so that means the day before Citizens United, corporations had a First Amendment right to make unlimited independent expenditures that did not contain express advocacy. We call them issue ads or sham issue ads, depending on how much you like or don't like the communication. The day after Citizens United, the one thing that changed, they could then put explicit words of advocacy in that message. But there weren't limits about general political participation. There weren't limits about general political spending. Lots of times you see the holding of Citizens United described as, you know, released corporations from the limits in political advocacy that they had. Well, there weren't any limits on spending for lobbying. There weren't any limits on spending for grassroots lobbying. There was some reporting stuff, but a lot of it is uneven. It kind of depends on the jurisdiction. There certainly weren't limits on spending on issue ads. So you might scratch your head and go, and the big deal is what? Well, the big deal is not legally so much what Citizens United did, but I think politically that it came at a time where there's tremendous engagement and interest in federal elections. There's a lot of controversy. It's very competitive in a lot of places. We may see, you know, a turnover of it, perhaps one or both houses in a midterm that has been seen as a referendum, fairly or unfairly, on the record of a president that has been very ambitious and very open about his interest in, you know, re-regulating the financial system, re-regulating the economy, doing things that people haven't done before. And guess what? If you're an American invested in politics, you're probably really interested in seeing that your interest is conveyed in this campaign. And so, of course, there's going to be a lot of spending. And there would have been a lot of spending without Citizens United, but Citizens United is sort of this extra little X factor that kind of has gotten people really concerned about some of the history of corporate involvement in politics, like Jerry was talking about. And I think that history, like I said, history is hard to see when you're part of it. The Progressive Era history is important to keep in mind, and also the history since the Progressive Era is there's sort of this interstitial period between the New Deal and the war, and then sort of now. Let's think about what happened to the notion of the corporation during that period. Because what we're not talking in Citizens United about Jay Gould's corporations or about the corporations that Elliott Root was railing against. We're talking about Citizens United. Well, what is Citizens United? It's a Virginia non-stock corporation. Well, what does that mean? That means it doesn't have any shareholders. Well, why have a corporation if you're not going to have shareholders and be involved in the economy and profit making? Because the corporation status today is essential for almost any sort of group activity. Not necessarily profit making. Not necessarily even charitable. That's probably, though I haven't studied this closely, an artifact of the way the tax code has evolved. Remember, a lot of the corporate stuff, when people talk about the original idea of corporation, happened before there was an income tax. So a lot of this is driven, I think, as unintentional consequences of people trying to order their affairs in a way that makes sense to engage in activity as an entity. And so you have all sorts of groups that wouldn't have been corporations before, but they're corporations now. And why? Because it gives them a tool to get a taxpayer's ID number so they can open a bank account in the name of the corporation. They've got an entity. They're not just an aggregate of individuals where the group might be vulnerable to somebody flaking out. Once you've got an entity, you've got a thing that proceeds beyond just the evanescent in participation of particular individuals. So fine. What Citizens United, I think, recognized correctly is that not all corporations have to be treated with one big broad brush, and in fact, it's inappropriate to. Would a more tailored law survive scrutiny? I don't know. Nobody's tried that yet. I can imagine, however, that there are jurisdictions that have special limits on, say, gaming licensees or liquor licensees or brothels in certain states, like my home one, and would feel that they had appropriate limits on the political expenditures of these particular kinds of licensees. You know, licensees that weren't really recognized as having a property right in their line of business in common law. You know, they're sort of disreputable for some reason. Would that succeed in front of this court or in front of a federal court following Citizens United? I don't know. Nobody's tried it. But I'm not sure it wouldn't. if the legislature could come to the courts and say, look, we have a really good reason why this particular industry, because it's a public utility, because it's a brothel, doesn't belong in the political conversation. They're just too dangerous. But like I said, it hasn't been tried yet. Now, finally, where are we going from here? Disclosure is the remaining sort of tool of political regulation in the wake of Citizens United, and there's been all sorts of what I consider to be ill-thought-through notions of what disclosure means now. I think disclosure still has to pass a test of being being related to some sort of legitimate state purpose. So you can't just write a disclosure law that is a proxy for burdening political speech or as a backdoor of suppressing a particular group or a particular industry that you don't like. I think incentives for donations are fine. I'm not sure they're going to give the satisfying result that maybe CFI does, but I'm certainly not against, especially in the state or local context, somebody experimenting with them. Because, and I will close with this, one of my favorite quotes out of Alexander Hurd's The Cost of Democracy from 1960. Actually, this, and they're saying this in the context of contributions by the underworld, which I think is kind of, we don't talk about the you know, political corruption with contributions of the underworld. But, you know, in 1960, they did. But this is his quote anyway. Maybe we should. Campaign money must come from someplace, and if the good people will not supply it, the bad ones will. which is sort of, and my sentiment there is a pluralist one. You know, if you don't like the fact that, you know, GE executives are giving money in a political process and you're a competitor of GE, well, you get your people too. Or if you're, you know, an adversary of GE in an environmental, you get your an environmental issue, you get your people too. In fact, you know, and ultimately it's pluralism that what keeps democracy supple and flexible.
Thank you.
That's all I have to say.
Peter?
Okay. Thank you. I'm really honored to be here. Thank you for including me in this. Otherwise, I'd be sitting out there trying to keep up. Instead, I'm sitting here trying to keep up.
Which is harder? You tell me.
Tell me in 5 minutes. There are about 3 points that I wanted to touch on here. Going back, as Allison did, to the first days after the CU decision and people assessing what it meant, one of the ideas that I heard a lot then and have continued to hear since then is that corporations are too risk-averse to get into this. And the more I thought about it, the more I just felt this doesn't hold up. You know, we don't know clearly. You know, there's all the 501c money that we just don't know where it came from. But if you look at the history of corporate involvement in politics, you know, they gave a lot of soft money to the parties. There was a big battle over whether that money would be disclosed early on. After disclosure became mandatory, they kept on giving. In fact, the soft money totals went up. They're happy to give to the host committees for the party conventions, which you know, the host committees are presented as nonpartisan events. But you know, we've all been to conventions; and we all know what they're like. They give to the Republican and Democratic Party governors' associations, and those are clearly partisan organizations, you know, giving directly for election-related activities. So the more I thought about it, the more it made me think that the idea of corporate money going into politics is like lobbying, where, you know, everybody says, you know, we really don't like to do lobbying. You know, it's distracting. But everybody else does it, so we have to. But everybody does it, and everybody does more and more and more of it. It's not like anybody ever cuts their lobbying budget in Washington. So my conclusion is that the Citizens United case as Allison says, did not give corporations a big new venue in which to play. But what it seems to have done, as far as I can tell, is it has given corporate lawyers and executives greater comfort in playing where they do play. So, you know, anecdotally, we get reports of corporations being active in this cycle, and possibly after Election Day, we'll get a more accurate picture. But it seems to me that that they are willing to get involved in this and get involved in a way that was not true before the decision. Another point I wanted to look at, Nancy's discussion of the party committees, the national parties, and where the Citizens United case and the general rise in outside money groups takes us. It's not so interesting on the Democratic side because all the Democratic big donors seem to have gone somewhere else this cycle. But if you look on the Republican side, just in the past couple weeks, American Crossroads, American Action Network, and American Future Fund announced that they collectively were going to put another $50 million into House races that hadn't been in play. They were going to put them in play. And the Republican National Committee has been, as far as I can tell, essentially invisible in this cycle. They're not running ads. They have not been doing what the DNC has been doing, which is making big contributions to the House and Senate committees. Their most recent disclosure report was, as of October 31st, they had $4.5 million on hand, compared to the $50 million that these three groups are just now putting into House races to make them more competitive. So that led me to the question of where this leads us. You know, this is all tune-up for 2012, right? So in 2012, are these groups still going to be active? Are they still going to be active at this level? What's going to happen with the Republican National Committee going into a presidential year? And when the people elected in 2010 come to Washington, who are they going to be looking to as their patrons? Is it the Republican National Committee, or is it going to be, you know, Karl Rove and Ed Gillespie at American, you know, with American Crossroads, and you know, sort of the RNC in exile? John Boehner has been doing a lot of fundraising for House candidates. Mitch McConnell's been doing a lot for Senate candidates. Jim DeMint's been doing a lot for Senate and House candidates. None of these people are the party, and the party is at a much lower level of visibility than it has been, since Watergate, I think. So I'm really curious to see where that's going to lead us. I also wanted to say a quick thing about the impact of all the 501c activity on just how I do my job. How I do my job is spending a lot more time on the computer trying to track these groups. I spent a couple of days trying to track down the Coalition to Protect Seniors, which is a C4, and the New York Times had a story on it a couple of weeks ago, I think. And I had done my thing before then and didn't get any further than they did. They were running ads. They're running occasional ads, actually. They're certainly not at the visibility level of American Crossroads or American Future Fund. They've been running ads in House races. They have a website. The website has a contact us email link, which you know, the emails that I sent went off into the ether somewhere. The website has a lot of discussion about Medicare Advantage, which is a program that did not fare well in the healthcare overhaul. So I started making calls in the, you know, healthcare lobbyists, health insurance lobbyists, because the health insurance industry runs the Medicare Advantage programs. And, you know, one person said, no, that wasn't us. You might try these guys. No, it wasn't us. Came to a bunch of dead ends. My conclusion is that someone who cares deeply about Medicare Advantage, presumably, but I don't know, cares for financial reasons. But as far as I can tell now, at least in my experience, Coalition to Protect Seniors is completely opaque. And, you know, I'm basically an advocate of disclosure. I think we should know more about them than we do, and I think it would be better for the election system if we did, but that's their decision. So I'm assuming that come 2012 we will see still more of this stuff. I assume we will see more 501c activity unless the IRS suddenly springs into action and cracks down on groups that they consider to have been registered as 501c's while acting as 527 political groups. And I expect that that it's not going to stop. Basically, that we're just going to kind of keep going from now straight through November 2012, at least.
Okay. Thank you for depressing us all.
Very uplifting. Doing my job.
Yeah, Spencer.
Sid, I want to thank you for that great introduction earlier. I'd get in trouble with my dean, though, if I didn't point out that I'm a professor of law at George Washington University rather than Georgetown University.
Did I say Georgetown?
I just want to stay out of
trouble
here.
Yeah.
Right.
I apologize.
Right. No problem. It happens all the time. So I want to focus today on Professor Rosenblum's remarks on political parties. I'm familiar with Michael's work, and our work overlaps to a certain extent, and I don't want to put you to sleep, you know, by parroting Michael here. Also, in terms of Professor Burke, I'm not a historian, right? So I'm not going to reveal my lack of historical experience by, you know, citing Wikipedia and how they have a different take on Professor Burke's work. Professor Rosenblum, however, she makes a number of insightful and provocative claims about political parties, and a lot of them I agree with, and I have some quibbles with a couple of them. Before we get to that, I want to focus on this news story of the day, the news story about secret money in politics and how it's such a big thing. We've got these independent groups, wealthy donors, corporate donors, giving money to independent groups. Now, I think as a policy matter, a political matter, a constitutional matter, we should definitely have disclosure of large contributions to independent groups. We can have debates about the sausage-making process here. We can talk about, you know, should the donors to the NRA be exempt from disclosure? Should this be a pure disclosure bill, or should we tack on spending restrictions on foreign-controlled corporations, government contractors, and oil companies? We can have legitimate policy debates about whether the amounts that have to be disclosed are currently too low or should they be higher. Real discussions on should we make the law less complex. I understand why the media right now is focused on secret money and disclosure. This is the fire of the moment. It's the fire that needs to be put out. It also seems like the low-hanging fruit because most people agree that they should know where this money is coming from, that we should know as a democracy. And so Peter, certainly please keep reporting here. But at the end of the day, I believe that we're going to have meaningful disclosure, and it's going to be ruled constitutional by the court. The question is going to be, what's next? And that's where we really turn to Professor Rosenblum's points here. Now, I agree with her point about the problem not being a lack of equality, but really extreme inequality. In other words, the problem isn't that we don't have this mechanical equality where all candidates have the same exact amount of money, or we've got the scenario where spending limits are in place, or they should be in place. That's not necessarily the biggest problem here. It's a little naive and unrealistic to accept, for example, that candidates who are competitive are going to value kind of formal equality over winning an election, right? So I agree with that. But I also, let's say, disagree with the class-blind approach, this notion that wealth is irrelevant, that government should always ignore class distinctions, that government shouldn't try to empower one group that's disempowered, this notion that disclosure, because it can deter big contributions just as it can deter small contributions, that we shouldn't have any disclosure. I have just a philosophical difference with that perspective, with the notion that, from my perspective, I believe that government of, by, and for the people requires that the people have some idea of where the large money is coming from, and that democracy has the power to ensure that government is not captured by one small class of people in our society. So government has the power to recognize massive disparities in the distribution of wealth. I also agree with her on this notion that often reformers ignore the poor and the disorganized, or the poor and the disorganized, that the democratic ideal is some kind of objective, deliberative notion. Her point here is that both sides, or reformers, others, take up just this one facet of inequality, that is the unparalleled corporate resources, right, versus the amount of money that most folks have to spend, and that they don't focus on the poor and the disorganized. She's also concerned about this criticism of responsiveness, this notion that loyalty and responsiveness is somehow bad. And I agree that some reformers are wrong when they don't want unions or the NRA to influence the process, where they're just dismissed as special interests, even though they represent a number of average Americans who don't have resources and wouldn't be able to participate in another way. There is this kind of upper middle class taint, as if politics is always deliberative, like some kind of courtroom, free from influence, and also that our biggest problem in democracy, opened up by Citizens United, is that as opposed to, you know, bundlers of $2,300 contributions steering money, we've now got corporations doing it, and that's the biggest problem. And there are some pluralist sympathies I probably have with Allison in terms of that. I think Professor Rosenblum is right on the money, and I think Michael feeds into this. This is a different way of putting it in terms of incentives, this notion of how can parties, not let's say the government here, but how can parties, political actors, be a major force behind the expansion of the electorate in terms of mobilization? So when we talk about something like allowing political parties to coordinate with candidates and using small donors' contributions to do that, I think that's good. It both encourages parties to go after small donors and include them, and it also allows for parties to coordinate with candidates to kind of mobilize and engage in real political activity. My biggest quibbles and problems here would be Professor Rosenblum's I think she's dismissive of the small donor match. And this is a match where, for example, you have a contribution of $100 or less, and it's matched 4-1. So small donors are more important. I agree with her that vouchers are politically impractical. But in terms of the match here, I think that, you know, her take is that these small donors can't offset the big donors. And I think that's an empirical point that she hasn't necessarily established. I would agree with her. There is a question at which how much of a match do you have to do so that small donors can offset big donors? I think that's an empirical question, and I don't pretend to have the answer to it. I also think that her take is that you won't get a less affluent set of political players at the table. And I think that in terms of small donor bundlers and others being engaged, I think you will get a less affluent set at the table. I would agree with her, though, in terms of her take that these matches or any kind of public financing shouldn't be limited just to candidates, that it should be extended to small contributors to political parties and PACs and really facilitating mobilization there. Finally, she proposes that we basically restore a variation of the soft money system. In other words, allowing parties to collect large checks in order to engage in mobilization of voters. My concern with this is that it's really a focus on elites rather than individual citizens, on how can we lift up parties so that they have more power relative to corporations. And I think that our real starting point needs to be average individual citizens rather than empowering particular elites here. I think that we'll just go back to the situation, you know, we talked about, you know, Lincoln bedrooms and this kind of thing, of political players focusing on these large donors to get the money that they need, which is one tool to mobilize voters that they need to mobilize, which and folks are seen as tools. Voters become tools as opposed to real democratic engagement here. I also think that third-party groups currently do this. The Tea Party, as I understand it from some reporting, is financed by the Koch brothers and some other folks. Certainly liberals have some large contributors who finance voter mobilization. And I think there's so many other things we could do to mobilize disempowered groups. I mean, 75 million people didn't participate. Okay. Could you give me some guidance in terms of?
Don't anybody take this personally. Thank you.
Okay. All right.
All right.
We're in good shape. Right. So there's 75 million people who did not vote in 2008 who were eligible. Of that 75 million, 80% were unregistered. The United States could modernize its voting system if the objective here is to include a number of folks who are disenfranchised. If the focus is solely on poor people and immigrants, right now a lot of states aren't complying with the public assistance provisions of the National Voter Registration Act, right? And if they simply complied, we could add 3 million voters to the rolls. There are 4 million people who serve their prison time but can't vote around the country. These people could be empowered, which would give parties and political players an incentive to go after them. Immigrants, right now, there's not uniform voter registration at naturalization ceremonies, despite the fact that immigrants, naturalized citizens, are less likely to be registered than other Americans. That's something else that we could do to empower the poor and the immigrants, in that case, immigrants. So in conclusion here, I think that there are two big questions that Professor Rosenblum raises that are important questions, that are key, that we can't overlook. Number one, what does Citizens United mean in terms of democratic participation? So not just the heat of the moment here, but the bigger questions. How do we include people in terms of participation? And then the second question here is, rather than command and control restrictions on money, how do we offer political actors, such as candidates and parties, more incentives to expand their efforts beyond their base to disengaged citizens? And those are two very important contributions of her work.
Thank you, Spencer, and my deepest apologies to George Washington University Law School. I didn't introduce Trevor before he got here. He was stuck in Washington traffic. It's a good thing because you're here to make sure I get it right. Trevor is the founding president and general counsel of the Campaign Legal Center, and he's truly one of the country's best known and most experienced campaign and election lawyers. He served on the Federal Election Commission from 1991 to 1995, a stint that included a term as FEC chair. And not surprisingly, as we'll soon see, Trevor has a wonderfully subtle, fine-grained understanding of the Citizens United case and its implications. So, did I get all that right?
Certainly not the fine-grained understanding.
Oh, okay.
We will see.
You had to push to it. The red light goes on.
The red light went on. Thank you. This is a great discussion. You did give me an hour and a half, right? To
the audience would have to vote.
Cover what the panelists have addressed and then go some. It really is a intellectual feast. Let me just hit a couple of high points. One is that this is a good moment to be looking at this. I have a sense we will be having conversations, we in a very broad general sense, probably for the next 2 years, because I think Citizens United reflected an enormous change in the way we are going to see elections funded. As I'll explain in a moment, I agree with some of the panelists who have said it is not solely responsible for the change, but I think it does reflect that. And if we look at the numbers we're seeing now, I think it's fair to predict they will be larger in the 2012 cycle, absent any significant changes in law. So we will have plenty of time to talk about how much money is spent and perhaps where it's coming from if we can find out and what it all means for how we finance our elections. It's, I think, correct to say that we need to be forward-looking and figure out what alternative methods of getting money into the system are, as the Campaign Finance Institute is suggesting, and Professor Rosenblum, if only because Citizens United is, absent further changes on the court, likely to be the law of the land for the next couple years, and it is therefore appropriate to stop talking about Citizens United and begin to figure out how we deal with the new landscape. Having said that, though, I do believe in history, and I believe it is important to understand what has happened in order to figure out what ought to happen next. So there are a couple comments I would make on Citizens United before we bury it and move on to the next endeavors. One is that if you looked at Michael's boiling over pot image up there, I like that image. One reason I liked it is that I think it accurately reflects the fact that there was pressure continuing for money to get out of the pot, but also if you're a cook at all, you know that in those situations, usually most of it stays under the lid. It's only some of it that actually gets out of the pot. And if you're looking at those numbers on those charts, I think there's a significant difference between the 200-some million that we were looking at in 2006 and the projected almost $600 million this year, and if I'm right that it'll be larger in 2012, it is not unimportant that the money is going up that much, and I think it really does have very direct effects on our election system and thus ones we need to take a look at. Secondly, in terms of what the court did, I really could spend an hour foaming at the mouth about how I think the court got the doctrine wrong in Citizens United, how it didn't understand corporations, et cetera. I won't do that. I would at least comment in passing, though, on Allison Haywood's point that, which I think is truly felt by a number of justices. If you listen to the arguments, you could see Scalia and his view of a corporation was not Exxon and GE. His view of a corporation was the corner barbershop and hairdresser. The idea that nowadays corporations are sort of ubiquitous and people do business as corporations and they really are just assemblages of individuals. There are, I think, two problems with that, as we're going to find out. One is that individuals, of course, had a right under Buckley to spend, so the corner hairdresser and so forth could do so with their own money. They didn't have to use the corporate checkbook. And secondly, the Supreme Court had dealt with the whole nonprofit issue years before in Massachusetts Citizens for Life, in MCFL, where they had effectively said that nonprofits can spend money in elections as long as the money isn't conduited from for-profit corporations. So they had dealt with what happens if you're a collection of people who happen to incorporate for liability purposes or because your lawyer told you to, but your real interest is in electing pro-life candidates in Massachusetts or any of the other causes that nonprofits are involved with. So I think there are and will be some continuing arguments about the corporate side of Citizens United and what it means. If I summarize the historical record very briefly, it would be to say there are two decisions there that together changed the landscape, not just Citizens United, but, of course, also Wisconsin Right to Life too. And both of those are by the new activist majority on the Supreme Court. We knew in the McConnell case that it was a closely divided court, 5-4. And what we now know is that Justice O'Connor's resignation from the bench and the arrival of Justice Alito has left it just as closely divided, 5-4, but the other way. And it's that one vote that gives us this complete sea change between those two cases, Citizens United and Wisconsin Right to Life, and opens the door for all this. And the reason I make that point is, this has been closely divided all along. McCain-Feingold was closely divided going through Congress. It was upheld closely. It has now been overturned closely. I'm not convinced the debate is decided. I don't know what the next Congress or the one after that are going to do or who's going to be on the court in a couple years, but I think this is all going to be in play. One reason is that the Supreme Court in Citizens United really made a very facile judgment that there is no corruption from independent spending. Going back, and the site says, see Buckley, where Buckley is basically talking about solo individuals acting on their own, not in concert or coordination with parties or candidates, spending their own money. There is no record in Citizens United, and we are creating records in this election and the time that will come afterwards. Peter's comments about, what are these people looking for? How will it change the lobbying situation in Washington? There was no record in Citizens United. There was no finding by a lower court that said there is no corruption from independent expenditures, huge independent expenditures, by corporations and labor unions. We will find out, I think. And we may end up concluding that indeed there is corruption when you have an entity that exists for the sole purpose of making money, and it spends money to elect people who will then give it a competitive advantage in Congress by passing laws that favor their company against others or their industry against others or blocking legislation or regulation that they don't like. We may end up concluding that we have a problem here that Congress will again want to deal with. I think everyone appreciates the irony of the Caperton case where the Supreme Court found corruption and independent spending in a judicial election, opinion by Justice Kennedy, and then coming back in Citizens United, Justice Kennedy says, oh, that's different. That's judges. That's not Congress. We'll see where that goes. I do think, though, that if you were looking at the immediate playing field, the other area that we're going to have to spend time on is disclosure, because this is, I think, one of the untold stories of the election. Everyone understands we don't have disclosure, and the Post writes articles saying it's a problem of the tax law and so forth. the Supreme Court has 8 justices who think the law requires disclosure. You have 4 in the majority and the 4 in the dissent. The only outlier is Justice Thomas, all of whom joined that part of the opinion that said, we have disclosure of this spending. Now, the Justice Kennedy and his 4 brethren were using it as an excuse, as a defense for their holding in Citizens United. They're saying you don't need to worry about having a problem with all this new corporate and implicitly labor money, but they were saying corporate money, because it's going to be disclosed. Shareholders are going to know what their corporations are spending their money on, and they can object. And voters are going to know who is funding these ads, the court says, as they ought to, because that's important in a democracy. And so they'll be able to make their decisions based on the sources of the money. So 8 justices read the law thinking they were going to have disclosure, because that appears to be what McCain-Feingold says, as if you run an electioneering communication referring to a candidate within 60 days of an election, then you have to report who the funders are. But what we have is a deregulatory group on the FEC to parallel the deregulatory group on the Supreme Court. And after the Citizens United ruling, we then discovered that 3 of the FEC's 6 commissioners believe that McCain-Feingold doesn't actually require disclosure of spending by these groups for these advertisements. Instead, they took a very narrow view, saying we think it only requires disclosure if somebody specifically gives money for a specific ad and earmarks it for that ad. Well, in my years of experience, I have never seen anybody give money for a specific ad. To start with, you usually don't have the ad when you're soliciting money. You say, if you give us money, we'll be able to make advertising and run it to elect or defeat. So we have a problem that is potentially fixable at the FEC in terms of disclosure. It is also, of course, fixable through Congress, whether it focuses on the tax law or whether it focuses on a broader requirement of disclosure in political spending. I think the lesson of the soft money battle, which took, 10 years probably, 6 or 7 hard-fought ones, is that you need disclosure as a start because people need to evaluate what is happening in order to judge whether there is corruption or the appearance of corruption, and if so, what to do about it. And so I think focusing on the sources of disclosure, finding out whether Peter Overby's group that has a website up there on Medicare Advantage really is medical groups that are focused on Medicare Advantage, or is that actually a clever feint and they're actually oil companies or some other group that wants you to think it's Medicare Advantage? We don't know. I think if we can deal with the disclosure side, we will then be able to figure out what else we ought to do, which, of course, is clearly, given the landscape, going to include what other sources of funding can be made available. It is exactly 103 years since President Theodore Roosevelt announced that there was so much money being spent by corporate interests who had an interest in legislation that the only way to deal with this was to give both national parties a grant of public funding so that they would have a way to cover election costs without relying on particular interests in party with an interest in legislation. So maybe 100 years later, things come around in cycles. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Trevor. You've been a remarkably patient audience, and I'm sure the panelists would like to react to each other, but I think they can do that as they respond to your questions and comments. There are a few simple ground rules. We have mics that are we're going to bring you a mic when you ask your question, so we capture it for our audio of this session. And we also ask that you stand. And finally, we'd like to know who you are, so tell us who you are when you ask questions. So, yes, sir, would you?
Are we you sure we're allowed to ask them who they are? That might be constraining.
I think that's okay. I think I've got a waiver from that.
Hello, I'm Bart Jansen, a reporter for Gannett Newspapers. I guess I wondered why anybody would think the parties and PACs would continue if contributors could make anonymous contributions to very similar organizations. Why should parties and PACs survive this?
Do you want anybody in particular to answer that, or should we just... Well, why don't Nancy and Michael respond to that, since we're the most forthright defenders of partisan.
You mean empirically why they will?
Yeah. Why would people give to a national party?
Candidates and parties have the great advantage of being able to work together openly. They are teams. In fact, that's one of the problems with the current law, is that they make it extraordinarily difficult for the parties openly to work as teams with the candidates, and they require this subterfuge called independent spending. And it's why we, together with Brookings and AEI in a report, advocated that parties should be able to do unlimited and coordinated spending, provided it comes from small donor money and doesn't become a loophole around contribution limits. Working as a team, they have many incentives that relate both to government and to mobilization that simply do not apply to these outside groups. And never will.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Do you want to say
no,
something?
Go ahead.
I think there are further answers. First of all, PACs themselves made relatively few independent expenditures. If we're particularly talking separate segregated funds, so corporate PACs, their PACs are often used for the purpose of making a contribution to a member so the member knows they have given. PACs are used because members ask for money because members need and want campaign funds. So they go to a lobbyist or a corporation and say, can you help me with my election? And the answer is, yes, we'll give you the check. I think it would be very unsatisfying to all of the parties in that transaction if the PAC said, well, actually, no, because we're going to make independent expenditures through some outside group. The expressive content of the contribution directly from the PAC to the member is, I think, what is important to the PAC in those circumstances. Also, you know, party committees as well, they need money to pay their officials and do what they do. They obviously, if the RNC had more money, it would be running more advertising, but I think there will be pressure from the party committees for funding so that they can turn around and directly fund their candidates as they do.
I think that's a very good question, and I think it raises a problematic issue. That is, to the extent that individuals and associations can spend money much more expressively, right, by paying for independent groups to attack this particular candidate or promote the candidate, this particular issue, right? Why in the world would they be concerned about party organizations and parties? And I think we live in an increasingly fragmented and nonpartisan political universe. That to the extent that we don't have party-identified voters, that is declining, more and more people are interested in their own causes, whether they're public interest causes or selfish causes, and inclined to support those organizations, the gear, their electoral and other advocacy that way. So I think that it really is, a very serious issue. And I think that there are reasons, of course, and I tried to give some of them, why we ought to be concerned about the strength of parties as institutions over time, that they perform functions and do things that no other political group does or can. But I think that increasingly we lose sight of that.
Yeah. I think that question is certainly relevant with regard to people who can afford to give a $30,000 contribution to a party as opposed to a $100,000 contribution to an independent group. But I think it also assumes that most party funding or almost all of party funding comes from such individuals. And I think that there are a lot of average, middle-class, working-class folks who give contributions to parties, to PACs, to other entities, and that they are important organizing tools and will continue to be in the future.
We have a question over here. Yes, sir.
Thank you. My name is Richard Clare. I'm from National Right to Work. And this is an excellent conference, and I thank you for having convened it. The question I have, and it may be that my ears just missed a straight comment, but there's a key aspect of the First Amendment that I don't think has been addressed by anyone, and that is the right of the citizenry to information flow. It's not so much that corporations have a First Amendment right to speak, but it's that American citizens and voters in particular have a First Amendment right to the information flow. And if a corporation does speak, whether it's speaking truth, falsehood, whatever, then that information is now in the public domain. Candidates can address it, parties, other groups, you name it. We have the information flow. And by the way, that same right applies to labor organizations. As you know, my organization doesn't like compulsory union dues going into politics, but we all have that First Amendment right to the information flow.
Jerry, do you want to respond to that, whether one has to protect corporations and other organizations as part of a information flow that's connecting that to speech? And maybe Trevor would want to respond to this, too.
Nothing comes to mind.
Well, that is, in fact, the argument that Justice Kennedy makes in his majority opinion. He doesn't talk about corporations are individuals and have a right to speak. He says that the First Amendment is there to protect information-reaching citizens, and therefore the government should not ban people who would like to provide that information, in this case, corporations and implicitly labor unions. So that, you know, you're on good ground in that you have five justices who agree with you. The minority says, first of all, if you're going to be consistent and what you think is that the government shouldn't ban any sources of information, then the majority is being very disingenuous in saying we're not talking about foreign nationals and foreign governments because that's potentially part of the information flow, and why is it okay to have the information from corporations but not foreign corporations or foreign nationals or whatever? So if there's information flow and that's the value, how are you going to adjust it to what the majority said, which is we're not touching in this decision foreign sources of information? And I think that's a question that is left up for the court beyond that. But what the minority would say is information flow is fine, but if information flow turns into a form of buying members of Congress through overwhelming spending to get legislation that benefits your particular interest at the expense of a broader democratic interest because others can't compete with you, then that may not be the correct reading of the First Amendment. So that was the argument back and forth in that opinion.
Michael?
It was a good question, and I want to take it to a different place. The argument that voters need information, which I thoroughly agree with, was also the reason offered by the Supreme Court in Buckley against Vallejo for disclosure. And many people are putting forward the argument, and I wish to preempt because nobody has put it forward today, but I want to put it forward, in connection with the Disclose Act, that it doesn't matter who sponsors the speech. Voters ought to be able to evaluate the arguments. So it's okay if you have an organization that the We Stand for Nothing You Ought to Know About Corporation except the contents of our ads, and let that go. Truth is that voters... voters, unlike the people who might be sitting here, don't spend all of their time trying to think about campaign finance law. They're actually normal people, unlike us, as we actually do this. In the flood, the barrage of information in the last month, it is terribly useful, very, very important to have cues, what are called, you know, shortcuts, information shortcuts. And among the most vital shortcuts, knowledge shortcuts, is that the organization stands up and says, we are the such and such organization, and those who fund us above a certain threshold level are the following. And you can look it up. Then you can evaluate, it helps you evaluate the speech. Knowing who the speakers are lets the voter make guesses about that are useful. So while I value the argument, I think it also needs to go to another place, and be applied there as well.
Do we have anybody on this side? Or I want to. Yes, sir. Yeah.
Hi. Thanks.
You have to stand up.
I got to stand up.
Can you lift your laptop? I've been given orders. Well, everyone must stand.
All right. I'm Ken Vogel with Politico, and there's been a lot of talk here about coordination between the parties and candidates, and whether allowing more coordination between the parties and the candidates could perhaps diminish the desire of some of these, or diminish the role of some of these groups, these outside groups that are funded by anonymous contributions that can't be traced, basically increase the amount of regulated money vis-a-vis this sort of flow of unregulated money that we're seeing now. But I'm curious more about the coordination between these outside groups and candidates, which is, of course, prohibited, or these outside groups and candidates or parties, which is prohibited. And I'm wondering if the panelists, particularly curious about Trevor, Allison, Michael, anyone else who wants to speak to it as well, believe that that these groups are violating either the letter or the intent of the coordination laws that are now in place, and further, if they think that having stricter coordination prohibitions with perhaps more precise triggers would also disincentivize this type of unregulated spending, but would result in these groups having less money or being able to have less to being able to do less with that money.
Trevor? Allison? Yeah. Would you want to comment on this? Yeah.
Well, I think coordination rules have real bite when you're talking maybe at the sub-federal electoral level, especially in sort of state and local races where there are similar rules going on, and you're talking about less sophisticated actors. But if what we're really fascinated about right now, mid-October of 2010, is what's going to happen 15 days from now, and the big groups that have been sort of singled out as being successful at raising money for expenditures, we're talking about a sophisticated set of people, and people who know how to do what they need to do within the law. And so I am not concerned that Karl Rove's lawyer, whoever he may be, is insufficiently sensitive to what the contours of the current FEC thinking on coordination, whatever that might be, are. They don't have to be. You know, you can't open a paper these days and not have some expert telling you where the marginal races are or where the DCCC has pulled out money, and so if you're a Democrat, you might want to facilitate spending there. It's you don't need to talk to the guy, you know, in a smoke-filled room to know how to spend your money. And so why would you? It would be stupid. Part of the picture, however, is that the coordination standard has been a ping pong ball between the FEC and the federal district court for several years now. And so to the extent that it is a moving standard, there is danger there that people will guess that the line is here, and it turns out that whenever the enforcement cycle settles down in 2 years or so, the line moved. It's happened. People have paid fines for conduct they thought was perfectly legal at the time because the standard changed in the course of the election or after the election. It's unfair, but there you go. But if you're asking me, are people in good faith trying to follow the law right now, I think absolutely, but that could change.
Did you want to come
in? I think this area is an area that illustrates the gap between the Supreme Court's view of life and reality. And this is actually not an attack on the Supreme Court. It's just that they assume, like most people, that coordination means you can't talk to each other about any of this. And so they safely say, well, as long as there's no coordination, if there's coordination, of course, then it's different. The reality, in fact, and has been ever since I've been involved in this area, is nobody really knows what coordination is. The FEC doesn't enforce it. I recall being there, you know, a number of years ago now, looking at clear coordination and having four of my colleagues tell me that didn't meet the standard. I'm not even sure, Allison maybe can correct me, but I'm not sure there are any cases where the FEC has found a violation in the form of actual coordination.
No, they can't get a rule.
Oh, and that's a whole separate issue, is that when Congress says to the commission, you know, you can't use your current rule because it doesn't catch coordination, go write a new one, and be sure to include the following. They don't. The courts throw it out. They write a new one. The courts say you still haven't done it. The reality is that the courts think coordination is important, and I think all the people in the political system have a sense that they can do an awful lot of winking and nodding without ever triggering whatever the coordination rule might end up being someday.
Peter, from no,
they've said it all.
They've said it all.
But I do want to say something for the sake of some listeners who don't follow the technical legal details, and this will not be responsive to the question necessarily. The reason this is an issue is that the law quite reasonably says that if two people coordinate, that counts as a contribution. And the functional or the active definition seems to be that unless you work together on a specific ad or communication, that doesn't count as cooperating. Allison is saying I'm wrong. Of course I'm wrong. I'm not a lawyer. But the point is that it's important only because if there are no operating coordinating rules, then you have sort of something like unlimited contribution.
Yes, right here. Yeah.
Thanks. Josh Israel with the Center for Public Integrity. Particularly in response to Chairman Potter's comment, President Obama has made one nomination to the Federal Election Commission. It languished in Congress for more than a year. He eventually withdrew his name. Why hasn't the administration made FEC reform a priority if disclosure can be something they deal with?
Oh, it's a long time since I was Chairman Potter. And if I knew the answer to that question, I could make a lot of money with my crystal ball. It beats me. I mean, this is an administration that came in saying campaign finance reform was important. It was going to have legislative initiatives in this area. I understand that they've had a lot of legislative initiatives and other priorities, but that doesn't explain the appointments process. What I'm told straight up is that they don't want to do anything that would offend the Republican leader in the Senate, and so they have asked, please, would he pretty please give them names, and he has not done so, and so they have been unable to move, and if they don't have any Republican names, then they can't have Democratic names. That does not, to me, illustrate that it's a high priority, and again, I can't figure out why it isn't a priority, but if someone else in the panel can shed light on it, I'd be thrilled, like former Justice Department officials who probably sat in meetings on this.
We just happen to have somebody.
Well, you know, I'm not speaking for the administration when I say this, but I think that there is a problem in the Senate. And the problem in the Senate, we don't just see it with the FEC appointees. We see it with judicial nominations. We see it across the board that senators put holds on candidates. It's a problem in terms of the Senate. So the administration has done a number of things in terms of appointments, nominations, and candidates are held up. They languish. They go to the Senate to be slowed down. So I think that one important thing here is that there are some issues in terms of the Senate right now in terms of both the filibuster and cloture procedure. I'd also make the point that the president has been a strong proponent of the Disclose Act. He's dedicated several Saturday radio addresses to the problems with secret, unlimited spending by corporations and individuals and contributions to these independent groups. And so I think that there has been a real commitment with regard to good government, lobbyists, disclosure, a variety of issues that have been unfortunately blocked in the Senate.
Yes, yeah, yes, sir.
Sorry, I'm Ken Doyle with BNA. I just, on the disclosure issue, picking up on that, isn't there a tension in the Citizens United decision itself between saying on the one hand it doesn't matter who's speaking, there shouldn't be limits on anybody if it's independent speech, it's just something that people should be exposed to and listen to and make their evaluation, as opposed to saying in that same decision it does matter who's speaking, We should know who's funding these messages. It's important for the voters to be able to evaluate that. I'm not sure where they're really coming down or whether those things are just intention in the same decision.
I think, again, it gets back to disclosure of what. You know, you can think of two extremes, neither of which probably serve any useful governmental purpose. You can think of an extreme where an entity, if it wants to make one independent expenditure, has to disclose all sources of revenue and maybe uses of revenue, like a political committee does. And you'd get reams and reams of information in the case of a large entity like the Chamber of Commerce. And I'm not exactly sure where the governmental interest is there. And I can certainly see burdens on free speech and free association when you have a rule like that, because you'd require disclosure of a whole lot of activity that has nothing to do with this one independent expenditure. And then I can see a rule on the other extreme, whereas only people involved in the crafting of the ad who were sources of revenue are required to be disclosed, and you'd have essentially just whomever it was who crafted the ad or whoever retained, you know, Alex Castellanos to craft the ad or whatever. And I just pulled his name out of the air. I'm not saying anything about him. Neither of those are going to serve a satisfying public purpose, but there has to be something in between there. Now, the Disclose Act's way of getting around this was to say, well, you know, if you're a source of revenue and, you know, we'll look back, I think, the year previous to the year of the ad, and, oh, and by the way, if you're a source of money and you specify that you aren't giving for political expenditures, then you don't have to be disclosed, which puts the responsibility on the donor. And I'm not sure how that all fits together when you look at the time profile and the look-back period. And I'm also not sure it's appropriate for the government to place that sort of onus on a donor. Not that the chamber's donors won't be sophisticated enough to comply with this, but I think part of the disclosure kind of debate we've got to get out of is thinking that every organization is the chamber, or every organization is, you know, America's Future Prosperity and Good Government, Inc., or whatever it is, and start thinking more broadly about, you know, where the rubber really does hit the road, which is those groups that aren't as well advised by the $600 an hour lawyers in Washington, D.C., and the ones that really do get wrapped up in the enforcement activities of the Federal Election Commission and end up, you know, being sort of the sad tales of woe that the Center for Competitive Politics likes to talk about. But one of the reasons we like to talk about them is because they kind of elude people's perception when they're talking in sort of general terms about what kind of disclosure is appropriate.
Ken, I didn't see the tension you're describing between those two. And the reason is I think what the court said was it's a good thing to have speech, and it's not the government's role to dictate where that speech comes from. That's the First Amendment element of it. But it says it's entirely appropriate for voters, citizens, and indeed shareholders of corporate funders to know where the speech is coming from, who is funding it. And I don't see those in conflict. To say it's a good thing to have speech whenever someone wants to speak, but they should tell people who they are. And as to the details, I won't go into great detail, but it does seem to me that what you say to the people running the ads is you have to tell people the source of the money. Now, if you want to have a separate account so that the source of the money is really clean and simple and only people who contributed to that account had their money used for the ad, fine. If that's not what you're doing, well, that's an option. If you want to use it out of your general treasury funds, then you have to disclose something about your general treasury funds, whether it's your top donors or whatever, so that people have a sense of whatever you want to tell them, but you have to, you're the one who knows how the ad got funded. Where did the money come from?
Nancy, do you want to?
Just two perhaps obvious things, but and I am certainly a supporter of any kind of disclosure. One is that there is the question of the threshold and the level. How small a donor has to disclose or doesn't have to disclose. I think that's a rather serious issue for people. The second is, again, this may be obvious, but the disclosure by itself is hardly transformative. The names of donors or of corporations isn't going to tell us very much. The question is going to be who's going to interpret it for us, right? And the other thing I would predict about this is that we're going to have a new interpretive industry, right? Beginning with Politico, right? And moving on because, as again, the revelation itself doesn't tell you something. It's the spin that you put on it, the political spin for what audience and how you communicate it.
Yeah, Peter, since Nancy mentioned interpreters, we were chatting a little bit before the session about whether the limits on disclosure, in particular these 501c groups, whether they how they affect your investigative reporting of your attempts to follow the money in campaigns.
It's a big deal. 2 years ago, 3 years ago, NPR and Center for Investigative Reporting ran what we called the Secret Money Project, where we tried to track all the outside money groups that were turning up, in the presidential election year. We found a lot that were playing at presidential level, a lot that were involved in Senate, even House campaigns. And, like American Future Fund surfaced that year, I think. I think that's the year they started up. And, we looked at these groups and we got for the 501Cs, we got usually a general sense of where they were at, but we had trouble getting a really good fix on why they were doing what they did. As the money moves from 527s and maybe from the party committees into the C4s, it makes it that much harder. I'm sort of at a loss here because, the journalism is about bringing light to, in this case, the money in the political system, and they are moving away from places where we can shine a light.
Yeah. Jerry.
One of the things that surprises me about the discussion is we have lost the point that was made earlier about political mobilization, right? It was made in the discussion of parties. It was made in the discussion of inequality in politics. The fact of the matter is if we don't pay some attention to questions of political alienation, we don't pay some attention to the relationship between all the technical issues, disclosure, the legal issues, the issues of spending, where money is spent, who spends money. If we don't pay attention to the relationship between that and political mobilization, it seems to me that what we're talking about is a kind of politics at the margins. Big money came into elections not to mobilize people. Big money came into elections to demobilize people. People have been fighting using big money to for years now to fight over voters at the margins. The brilliance of the Obama campaign, as far as I was concerned, and for anybody who uses money in this way, was that they linked raising money. It wasn't merely that they raised money from small donors. It was that they linked raising money to old-fashioned grassroots elections. They had some brilliance in the way that they thought about organizing using shoe leather, old-fashioned shoe leather, and attaching it to very high-tech kinds of electoral strategies. Yeah. The problem, as Nancy raises it, this problem of party, some of the organizers from the Obama campaign came out to Oregon, and one of the things that was incredibly interesting to me was listening to them talk about very innovative organization, but that innovative organization was effervescent. It had no links to the party at all, none at all. And so we can debate the technicalities here, but if we don't continually push back and ask ourselves, what the relationship is between all these questions and voter interest, simple voter interest. From my point of view, maybe disclosure is bad. maybe disclosure is bad is because it makes voters cynical, you know? To let, you know, maybe that's a bad thing, you know? But at least I think those questions are also really worth keeping on the table. And they were put on the table. I think they... I just wanted to put them back on the table.
Yeah, I wanted to, before I hear from you, I just wanted to ask a slightly a different kind of question, because Allison raised earlier an issue that I've always found interesting, is that is the equivalent of the corporation and the union in a lot of these cases and law. And you asked whether or not that makes sense, and you asked it. It's a genuine, that wasn't a rhetorical question. How did this happen, and does it make sense in your mind, who studied, you know, corporations and unions over a long period of history?
You know, in electoral law, I don't know. I mean, earlier on, there were these battles to incorporate unions and gain the same rights, you know, that corporations had. You know, it just seems to me you're talking about such different entities, right? I mean, you're talking about, you know, how many organizations do we have in American society, as weak as unions are, that genuinely link voters to, with weakened parties? I don't know that we have any organizations that link average folks, you know, to the electoral and political system anymore, you know? And it strikes me that unions are one of those things that do, right? You know, it's not surprising to me that SEIU, which has been so aggressive in organizing, you know, in organizing poor immigrant workers, for example, in Los Angeles, you know, and linking their strategies very much to politics, to California politics, to county politics, and to city politics, it's not surprising to me that that's the wing of the labor movement that's so concerned about this, because that's the wing of the labor movement that's really been concerned about mobilization of new people into civil society, into the system of organizations, whether they're organized as corporations or not. And that's the people who have been interested in organizing new people, especially immigrants, into politics.
Nancy, and then Trevor. Yeah.
I just wanted to expand on Jerry's original point that he made about mobilization, and to take us outside of the electoral context, right? Because there's big money outside of elections. If you just think of lobbying, or if you think of corporate speech, every time a major piece of legislation comes up, right? Ads around health care, for example. I mean, it's very clear that you need political mobilization to resist this. Quite apart from small donations during campaigns, you need parties and party identification. And I think that one of the things that Obama tried to do, and I don't know that we now know whether it was successful or not, was to take this organizing from America, right? This apparatus that had been built during a presidential campaign, and to try to use it in the course of governing, right, to provide a sort of grassroots mobilization in support of certain kinds of legislation. It has been studied, but I don't know that we know conclusively whether it's been successful or not. But it is an example of this need for political participation and to look at money quite apart from elections. Mm-hmm. Elections is not the whole story.
Yeah. So. I've studied that great detail, and I don't know. but I will tell you they did a lot of stuff that has not really been come to light that would be very interesting to study more. Yeah, Trevor.
I was just going to answer your question historically, sure, which is the equivalency of corporations and unions dates back to 1947, mm-hmm. and the Republican Congress. Republicans, having taken over, said their view of the world, which I think was probably accurate in 47 from everything I've read, was that you had two roughly equal great economic forces. You had the business community and you had the unions. And you had unions in that period capable of shutting down entire industries, virtually the country. You had very high rates of union membership compared to what we have now. And so the Republican Congress said, we have a ban on corporate spending. We should have a ban on labor union spending, and we'll treat them the same. Jump forward to the 1970s and the Watergate reforms, post-Watergate reforms. Congress took that structure and created, in the election law, rules for corporations and rules for unions. Yeah. And the FEC has enforced that ever since. There are two problems with it. One, the world has changed in terms of economic forces. But two, and it's not clear that anybody thought about it from a constitutional perspective, and Allison's point is the Supreme Court has never thought about it from a constitutional perspective. They've never said unions are voluntary associations except when they're not voluntary, and corporations are, you know, a totally different animal, and why are these being treated under the same prohibition? Yeah. The courts never asked that question, and one of the interesting things about Citizens United is everyone knows that the court said that labor unions have a constitutional right to make independent expenditures. They never said that in Citizens United. We just think it must be self-evident from their theory. And the FEC has announced they're going to read it that way. But the court never used the word labor union in the decision.
Oh, thank you. We have time for a couple more questions. Yes?
Hey, Danielle Kurtzleben, U.S. News. As Ms. Hayward noted earlier, the issue ads were always acceptable before Citizens United, and spending on those has increased dramatically even since then, especially among the Chamber of Commerce and 501Cs. What I'm wondering is, do you think that sufficient attention is being paid to groups spending on those and their reasons for spending on those instead of independent expenditures? Thanks.
Who wants to take a crack at that?
Since you mentioned my name, I guess I'll start anyway. Well, sure, because there's a couple of material reasons why you would, sort of from a legal standpoint, because as long as you're still engaged in issue advocacy, you're not making the expenditure that might trigger political committee status or the analysis of political committee status. And so certainly there is a space out there for groups that want to, you know, change the world to use issue ads. Though they are less direct, the argument goes back and forth, especially in the evidence that's raised in various court cases, that there's really no distinctive difference between the communication that the person gets. But I find that just sort of, you know, anecdotally to me a little difficult to believe that the ad that says, you know, so-and-so doesn't, you know, support your view of Social Security, call them and tell them to change their view, is materially the same as don't vote for X. I just have a problem with, you know, it's an advertisement. It's on TV after all. The more direct and more, you know, specific an ad is, the easier time it has cutting through the noise of whatever else is going on in the room. Though that's just my sort of anecdotal impression, and I could be wrong about that. So anyway, so issue advocacy certainly still has a place as a legal matter, and so organizations that are concerned about having been formed to use the 501c4 structure to change the world, not wanting to trigger political committee status, which occurs when your principal purpose is political activity rather than issue advocacy, are going to want to continue to use those. And in fact, since at least my understanding is the prevalent law right now is it's the fiscal year of the C4 that you look at, not any particular month or discrete period, to determine whether or not that principal purpose line has been crossed, there will certainly be, after the election, I would assume, a great interest in issue advocacy of, you know, do we believe in Santa Claus? I don't know what it's going to be. Actually, I do know, I think, what it's going to be, because there will be a lame duck session, and they'll have lots of things to talk about related to that.
I was vigorously shaking my head only to the predicate of the question, which was, up until before Citizens United, issue advertising was unlimited and unregulated. It actually was unlimited and unregulated until McCain-Feingold. McCain-Feingold is what came in and said you can't use corporate and labor money for it during the period in the middle of the election. And it was the Supreme Court in Wisconsin Right to Life that then came in and said, actually, no, you can do whatever you want so long as you don't do the functional equivalent of express advocacy. So I just wanted to pin the tail on the donkey and say it was the Supreme Court that gave us this unlimited issue advertising. My own sense is that we're seeing a lot of it this year because people, humans are slow to change, and to fully appreciate the changed legal environment we now have, I will bet you will see less issue advertising in the next cycle and more direct advertising, particularly because the FEC reasonably late in the game came up with these super PACs so that there are ways to do it. Now, having said all that, Allison's right. There are very complicated tax questions behind all this. And if the law didn't change at all, and if you were someone who wanted to fund advertising without ever disclosing who you were, then you're in the C3, C4, C6 world, and in that world there might be arguments for issue advertising.
Peter?
Yeah, I would say why run ads that get you into the world of disclosure if you don't have to? you know, as a C4, you can run ads that, you know, rip the opposing candidate apart, you know, eviscerate him just the way you would in express advocacy, but without that, you know, the express advocacy tagline at the end. You can, you can do that, say, you know, so call Joe Doakes and tell him it's time he left Washington. I don't know. No, you can't say time he left Washington, but you can say, you know. Okay.
Maybe.
Okay.
That's comforting, maybe.
Yeah, Trevor and I will talk about this later. might be a pretty good line. Anyway, and then after the election, given the way things are going, you know, the unrelenting intensity of the political/legislative process, these groups can swing into doing ads on issues in which you can launch personal attacks on the members of Congress and you know, tell them that it's time they rethought the way they were going to vote on this thing. You know, there's not that much difference. And, you know, so why get into disclosure when you don't have to?
We have time for one more question. Yes, sir.
If I may get a second bite, Rich Clare again from National Right to Work. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think the Citizens United case rendered any kind of decision with respect to disclosure, because I don't think Citizens United contested the disclosure provisions that would apply to it if it lost on the other issues. Yes, there were comments, side comments, that might give us some insights into what the court might do in the future, but lawyers and judges call that dictum. So there was no binding decision, I don't believe, with respect to disclosure in that case. I think when we talk about disclosure in the larger sense, we need to keep in mind the historical underpinnings of it, going back to the NAACP versus Alabama case, where state governments were trying to smoke out membership donor lists of the NAACP to put a decisive end to the civil rights movement back in those early days. And today we have referendum groups now that are under attack in the same way. And something the general public may not know at all, there are some people that do not have to disclose their donors to the FEC on the public record, the Socialist Workers Party being one. So we need to keep those principles in mind as well.
Trevor and Allison, do you want to comment quickly on whether you feel the case was decisive on, or how decisive it was on disclosure issues?
Well, I mean, it said what it said. And, yeah. You know, what certainly it's not res judicata on the disclosure question if it came up in another, you know, case. But I think it's pretty clear that they were ruling with the background of the rest of the law remaining stable. But certainly, you know, disclosure has to be tailored to a legitimate government interest and shouldn't burden the rights of people to participate in politics. And that's the tension there that you're talking about, is, you know, the potential for harassment from people being disclosed as being supporters of controversial topics.
In all due deference, I don't read the case the way you do. I don't think it's dicta, because what they said, what Citizens United said, is we shouldn't be covered by the law and prohibited from doing this. The court said you are not prohibited from spending because we find there's a constitutional right, and therefore we're going to strike down the prohibition on corporate funding. Then they turned to the disclosure question and said, however, you are still required to disclose the sources of funding under the Act. You argue you shouldn't. We think you're wrong. That's the 8-1 point in the decision. We uphold that section of the Act and say it does apply to you. And it doesn't apply just to express advocacy, but it applies to talking about candidates. So I think that was a very square holding of the court in the decision. As Allison says, you know, clearly someone's going to come back and say, well, but we're different, and make another argument.
Yeah. Well, I'm incredibly grateful to our panel for a great discussion. I'm very grateful to our patient audience for all your good questions and comments. So will you join me in thanking our panelists, please?
And we thank our hosts very much. Thank you both for putting this together.
Thank you.